This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. You can send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. If you don't hear your question read on the air immediately, it may be because your question is too detailed or too long, and you may require an actual medical or nutritional consultation. Alternatively, we have a lot of questions, so it may take listening to this weekly Q&A for a couple of weeks before we get, what are we, about 2-3 weeks behind in terms of getting the questions?
Yeah, I would say about 3 weeks behind, yes.
3 weeks, because we have a surfeit of questions, but eventually we'll usually get around to answering questions of general interest. And I'll remind you that this podcast is free, and we appreciate very much your listenership. We do this as a labor of love, but it does take time and effort and some money to produce. And so to assure your continued access to quality podcasts like this and the other podcasts that we do throughout the week, we ask that you check out our store at the Hoffman Center, hoffmancenter.com or drhoffman.com, and look at some of the products. We stock the best quality products. We curate our store very carefully for high-quality products at the most economical costs. And you can do yourself a solid in a couple of ways. You'll assure continued access to free information that's of value, as well as access to supplements of the highest quality if you patronize the Hoffman Center store. And we thank you for that. So what's your next question, Layla?
Okay, we've got an email from Aaron. Aaron writes, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Thanks for your amazing podcast." You're welcome, Aaron. "I was recently looking into buying a Vitamix machine, and they claim that breaks up food to a cellular level. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if this is a good thing, or if this might cause leakage of particles that are not supposed to get into the body, get into the bloodstream, you know, specifically for those who have a leaky gut." What a thoughtful question.
It is a thoughtful question. So let's try to tackle it. It would seem, though, let me try, you know, and then I'll let you chime in. It would seem that the product, the process of mastication, of chewing, would do something similar to what the Vitamix does. And there probably is some net benefit and maybe some net downsides to the breaking up of these particles. Mostly benefits, because you may liberate the compounds that are inside the cells or inside the fibrous material of plants and thus make them more accessible. On the other hand, there actually are some reactions that are supposed to occur in the mouth. And I'll give you an example. I recently wrote an article and I recently did a podcast on the subject of sulforaphane. And the way that sulforaphane gets produced in the body is that plants have both glucoraphanin, which is a glucosinolate, which is a precursor to sulforaphane, and they have myrosinase in the plant, but in actually different, slightly different compartments within the plant. And when you chop down on the raw or lightly cooked plant, you don't want to cook these, you know, cabbage family vegetables too much. Or if you have raw broccoli sprouts, that's an ideal source of sulforaphane. The myrosinase acts on the glucoraphanin, converting it to sulforaphane literally in your mouth. So, you know, is that something that occurs in the Vitamix? Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe this has never really been studied. But it seems that the act of chewing at the right temperature and pH is what actually facilitates the production of this valuable sulforaphane, which you can read the article and listen to the podcast with all the benefits. It's neuroprotective, it's anti-cancer, and it's really good stuff. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, the Vitamix machine is doing the digesting for you, Aaron. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you would masticate, just as Dr. Hoffman said, and all your salivary amylase begins breaking down carbohydrate in your mouth. Once it gets down past your esophagus into your stomach, all your gastric juices, the hydrogen chloride, and further down in digestion, the small intestine is also releasing a whole lot of enzymes to break it down to, you know, monosaccharides, disaccharides, polypeptides to tripeptides to dipeptides and mono and so forth, breaking it down to the cellular level. And that's what's supposed to happen with digestion. People who have a leaky gut, the tight junctions in the gut membrane have been loosened by some kind of, you know, by some kind of intruder or something foul, be it an NSAID, be it a bad diet, be it
bad,
you know,
bacteria, parasite, yeast,
all of that.
Even
exactly.
Even vitamin D deficiency or certain other nutritional deficiencies can cause those tight junctions to not approximate each other and, in effect, lead to leaky gut. So
yes.
You know, that's one of the reasons why vitamin D may be helpful in ulcerative colitis, is that it actually helps to repair the tight junctions. So, I guess it's a roundabout. To the question, though, I don't think that's a realistic prospect. I don't think you're going to create leaky gut by taking...
No, you're not going to create leaky gut. You've basically digested outside your body, and now you're drinking the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I think, unless the gut is already compromised.
Yeah, and the nice thing about the Vitamixer, unlike a juicer, you don't throw away the pulp. There may be some beneficial compounds that reside in the pulp.
Right. I do want to warn, Aaron, anytime you're going to use a Vitamix or a blender or anything to break down the food, you don't want to save enough for the next day. You want to drink that product immediately.
Right.
Because you're losing nutrition once you begin processing it that way.
Yes.
Whether it's blenderizing it, whether it's cooking it, anything.
So here's another consideration, though. Here's another consideration. Is they recently did a study on caloric consumption of pistachios two different ways. Mm. One is the shelled pistachios, which I exclusively use because they have shelled pistachios, but they also have the pistachios in shell. Mm. And I always, I always like them in the shell because it slows down your eating. You know, you have to work at it. Sometimes you find one sometimes you find one that's like only partially open, and you have to kind of get your fingernail in there or maybe use another shell to crack it open. And it takes a little work, and that sort of slows you down. It's the studies show that you consume only about half the calories when you actually have to work at opening up the pistachios. I think a similar thing happens when you consume fruit juice or vegetable juice. If you blenderize it, it's much more palatable. It's easier to, take in a lot. And, can you OD on vegetable juice? Well, yeah, maybe you can get too much in the way of oxalates, which some people have problems with. It can cause joint problems. It can cause kidney stones. You can get too much in the way of the goitrogens. Yeah, you're thinking along the same lines. If you like juice cabbage or something like that. And if you chew, that slows you down a little bit. And you may achieve satiety more quickly. With fruit juice, I mean, that's a problem because, fruit juice is in moderate amounts is great, but in large amounts, you're delivering a fairly high dose of refined carbohydrates, including fructose. And so, it's almost a little too delectable. And, of the principles of the diet I'm on, the Whole30 diet, is not that the food should taste bad, but food that's a little too delectable, you want to stay away from because you tend to overconsume it. It's one of the reasons why, even if you're not allergic to cheese, it's pretty addictive. You sock away
addictive.
A lot.
Well, you know, it's the casomorphins. It's the opioid, you know, circuitry and all that. But, you know, I think the biggest problem people, you know, the biggest problem with using a machine like that is people are often blenderizing bigger portions than they would actually eat. And here's the dilemma.
Yeah.
So, yes, you are taking in more calories, number one. Of course, you're going to drink, you could easily drink the juice of five oranges from a cup, but you'd never eat five of them, would you?
No.
That can still cause a fatty liver down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole lot of fructose. That will still raise your triglycerides. That will still impact your blood sugar adversely the same way a cup of soda will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it.
I don't remember the last time I ingested five oranges in a sitting.
No, it's that's it's the whole notion of slow food. You know, sort of
slow food,
slowing down your onslaught in terms of your.
If you take an ounce of pistachios in the shell, will take a whole lot longer to eat than the 30 shelled pistachios, which is great.
Well, according to the experiment,
now you look like you've got a whole mess of pistachios.
In the experiment, they just gave people like an unlimited supply, and what they found was that the ones that were shelled, that people ate half the amount. Even though they were, I mean, it would stand to reason that if you have the same hunger level, that you'd work a little harder and you'd consume just as many shelled pistachios as unshelled pistachios. But it turns out that the work slows you down, maybe allows time for satiety signals to catch up with you. I mean, this is a big issue with meals,
That's
is that if
true.
You consume stuff too fast, the satiety signals are delayed. So if you gobble down your food, that's a way to overcome the satiety. You know, if you want to win the hot dog eating contest at Coney Island, you don't say, "Well, here's a, you know, we've got 3 hours. See how many hot dogs you can." No, it's done in half an hour or something.
I don't know why anybody would create such a horrible contest.
It's a horrible contest. You know, athletic competition
horrible.
Is supposed to exalt you. You know, it's supposed to be something worth. You know, even football, which some people think is violent, you know, it's supposed to cultivate teamwork. It's supposed to cultivate resilience. It's supposed to cultivate athletic skills. And there's training.
This only cultivates vomiting.
I just don't get why this is even a competition. You know,
I know.
It's so strange.
Yeah.
Our culture is really weird. You know, there's an art to it. One can learn how to suppress the gag reflex and train your stomach to consume, 70 hot dogs with bun?
Oh, my God.
Don't even want to
go
there.
I've lost my appetite.
Okay.
No.
Well, that's
Aaron,
good.
Thank you very much for your very thoughtful question.
Hey, that's a good way of dieting. It's like, you know, next time you're, like, really hungry, just, like, mm-hmm. just play a tape of the hot dog eating contest, you know.
I could never even watch that without getting nauseated. Oh, yuck. Anyway.
Well, that's because you're a nutritionist.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. Oh, gosh. Okay. We've got an email from Beth. Beth says, "I'm a 55-year-old wife and mother of three sons. For 12 years, I've been living with neuromyelitis optica, also known as Devic's disease.
Okay.
I would love to hear from you what you think about hyperbaric oxygen therapy from me."
Okay. That's a really great question, and I have to say that I don't know this specific entity. This is a rare eye disease, and I'm not an ophthalmologist, and so I'm not familiar with a specific disorder. And I kind of doubt that because of the rarity of this disorder, whether there have actually been studies or whether you actually managed to find enough patients willing to undergo hyperbaric oxygen to see if it's efficacious. So, there is information that a certain type of possibly similar eye problem can respond well to hyperbaric oxygen. And that is optic neuritis. Now, optic neuritis is sometimes associated with or a prelude to multiple sclerosis. It's an inflammation of the optic nerve. And this may be an appropriate analogy to this condition this lady describes, or may not be. So I can't say with assurance. But there actually is some evidence that delivering high levels of oxygen to the inflamed nerve, the optic nerve, can help with resolution of that condition. So on that basis, I would say consult the place that I send patients to here in New York is Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. They have three offices in New York and Long Island. And I just sent a patient over there who was about to undergo radiation for prostate cancer. And I thought that getting hyperbaric oxygen at the time would be a really appropriate way to accentuate the benefits of the radiation and also to mitigate any damage to surrounding tissue. So that's actually one of the more well-established uses of hyperbaric oxygen therapy. You go into a chamber. It's a Lucite chamber. You can actually don't feel claustrophobic like you're in a diving bell. You can see outside, but it's a very high-tech glass-enclosed cylinder. And under high pressure, oxygen is delivered to you, and you sit there for, I don't know, half an hour, and oxygen is delivered to deep within your body at high pressure. So is it helpful for this condition? It might be worth a trial of therapy. You know, you'd have to consult with them to see what a meaningful trial might be. It might be a dozen. It might be 20 treatments. It might be covered by insurance. It might not be, since it's kind of its use is kind of experimental in that condition and not well established. Unlike, you know, wound healing is covered. Healing radiation damage is covered. Certain other types of conditions are considered, you know, more mainstream applications of hyperbaric oxygen.
It's becoming more and more popular. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
It's very popular in Europe. I think it's got you know, perhaps more, you know, they're a little more cutting edge and innovative there in relationship to.
Are there any side effects to this therapy?
Yes, yes, there can be. Yeah, there can be. So one of the things with hyperbaric oxygen is, you know, that sometimes there are pressure issues, you know, with the ears. So people can't equalize pressure with the ears. It's a little like diving, you know, when some people with ear problems have difficulties.
Okay.
So, you know, you have to be appropriately medically screened. But most people tolerate it very well. I mean, people obviously with claustrophobia, that might be an issue, being in a chamber. You know, so, you know, I think that there are some issues where, you know, maybe people with very unstable heart conditions may not be appropriate for this. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
I will add, we had, I mean, this is maybe a completely different circumstance. We had an unusual case of a young man who you're well familiar with, who had a terrible lung infection. He almost died and was in the intensive care unit for several weeks. And one of the consequences of that is he developed abscesses in his body, one in his liver, several in his lung, but also an unusual abscess in his eye. And they said, you know, you're going to be blind. They said, you know, your vision is shot. And there's no chance of recovery. And so, you know, he came to me and asked the same question. He said, do you think hyperbaric oxygen could be helpful? And I said, I don't know. I mean, you're sort of doing it on spec. It's on a wing and a prayer, but what do you have to lose? And he went and he got the treatment, and he's responding. He's responding well. His vision is not perfect, but he has sufficient vision together with his good eye to have normal binocular vision after a series of treatments, and he's actually quite happy with the outcome. Now, again, this is a different circumstance than this lady describes.
Yes.
Just because it's an eye problem doesn't mean that, you know, all eye problems respond in a similar way. It's not a panacea for all things eye-related.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Beth, we wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, and thank you for
going forward.
And thank you for, you know, advocating for yourself and inquiring about what may be an innovative avenue towards at least slowing the progression of the disease and perhaps ameliorating it. Way to go. Mm-hmm. We have time for a quick question, if such there be.
Oh, Okay, well, we're going to make this quick. Dear Dr. Hoffman, this is from Gladys. Dear Dr. Hoffman, what supplement lowers high levels of LDL?
Well,
without getting into the whole cholesterol conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Panethine.
Mm-hmm.
Fish oil can help. A change in your diet is the number one thing.
Right. Also, I think we could mention niacin.
Niacin, plant cereals, yes.
Bergamot, which is in
bergamot.
The, bergamot. Which product incorporates bergamot that we have?
It's the Cholestapure.
Cholestapure. Now, bergamot is actually what is the flavoring in Earl Grey tea.
Yes,
and
my favorite.
Yeah, and bergamot in a more concentrated form can lower cholesterol. So that's one of the things that could make a difference. And, of course, there's, you know, red yeast rice definitely will lower LDL. Red yeast rice is actually sort of a natural form of a statin. It was originally the basis for the discovery of statins, is that a certain fungal species that could be cultured on rice had a cholesterol-lowering effect. Interestingly, that red is the same red that's used in Peking duck, which is a pretty high cholesterol food, right? So if you take Peking duck that's got the red yeast extract on it, maybe that ameliorates the cholesterol effect of the red yeast of the duck. Although we already know that dietary cholesterol is kind of a incomplete correspondence to blood cholesterol. Some people, can consume lots and lots of eggs and lots of saturated fat with cholesterol, and their cholesterol doesn't go up. Or if the cholesterol goes up, the cholesterol goes up, but so correspondingly does the HDL, and the cardiovascular risk doesn't increase.
Right.
And so it's the sugar that raises the cholesterol, the refined carbohydrates.
Right, right. And, you know, cholesterol works on a negative feedback loop when the liver sees that there's enough dietary cholesterol coming in. It doesn't have to make so much because the liver already makes 80% of the cholesterol in our body. Why? Because it's necessary.
Yep.
It's a constituent of all of our cell membranes in our brain. Yeah.
They recently, to give you an idea of some of the effects of lowering cholesterol artificially, they did a study of a condition called interstitial lung disease, which is second to emphysema, the most common cause of lung death. And it's actually the cause of my father passing away because he developed pulmonary fibrosis. And he was not on a statin, but it was found that patients who are on statins have a more rapid progression of pulmonary fibrosis. Why? Perhaps because cholesterol metabolism protects the lungs. It has a protective effect, and by depriving the lungs of cholesterol or blocking that enzyme that synthesizes cholesterol in the body, the HMG-CoA reductase, may cause damage to certain tissues in the body, perhaps the brain, perhaps the lungs.
Yeah.
So, you know, while statins may be useful for a certain subset of people at high risk for cardiovascular disease, just to sprinkle them in the drinking water or have people at very low risk take them for years, there may be other risks that develop that are a consequence of lowering cholesterol, lowering LDL.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is turning into a long question, but I will say this. You say, well, let's lower the LDL. You don't always have to lower the LDL. What you can do is you can change the LDL. You can change the particle size. So what we like to do is the VAPS test or the lipoprotein fractionation. And large, fluffy LDL has a much more benign prognosis than small, dense LDL. And so just an LDL of 130 in one person may be very bad, and another person may be quite benign. So just that using that absolute number is
a large pattern A.
It's dumbing it down. And then, of course, we have these other offsetting factors like, high HDL can have a offsetting effect on a high LDL.
And, still not enough doctors pay attention to triglycerides if they're nice and low.
Yeah.
That I think the triglyceride number can be a more important number than the cholesterol itself.
Absolutely. It's whenever we see the high triglycerides, we know that people have carbohydrate intolerance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So enough said. So a reminder that Layla Mudin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist, is available for consultations should you wish to consult with her and say you can't come to the Hoffman Center for a full medical workup, as we encourage you to do, but say you're somewhere else, you like your doctor, you want to keep your doctor. If you share with her your medical records, she can consult with you about an appropriate nutritional program, including supplements. And recently you had just such a consult. Was it from out of state? Some people are taking advantage of that option.
Yes, I have clients from all over the country, even Hawaii.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And nobody's invited you to become their personal nutritionist out there on the island of Maui?
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Okay.
No, it's all being done by phone so far.
Okay. We don't want to lose you. We don't want to lose
you. While I await that invitation.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. So thank you very much for joining us, folks. And thank you, Layla. And
thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
Once again, send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we'll endeavor to answer them on an upcoming edition of our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.